listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
We talk a lot about happiness here in the United States, and yet happiness seems a difficult concept to define, much less to create and live. Can you at this moment, for example, tell a friend exactly what happiness is and the steps to take in order to create and live happily in his or her own life? Our guest today, Manel Bosells, can. Welcome to Full Power Living, the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host, and during this broadcast, we invite you to interact with us on our two chats, one on the emotionalpro.com radio page and the other on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living. We also have a toll-free number, 800-630-7858. That's 800-630-7858. So call us. Manel Bosells is professor of business and economics at the, if I hope I can say this even approximately correct, the Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, Spain. Over the past 10 years, he and his co-author, Rakesh Sarin, who is Payne Professor of Management at the Anderson School of Management, University of California, Los Angeles, they've examined and analyzed data and evidence from all over the world to come up with a set of laws that govern our happiness. These laws are supported by findings from scientific experiments and examples from ancient literature and pearls of wisdom from the world's religions and spiritual practices. The laws of happiness are universal and apply to all of us. The two authors, for example, one comes from the culture of Spain and the other of India, and the laws work for them despite the many differences in the way they see the world. This is the stuff of today's show, so Manel Bosells, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you very much for hosting me.
My pleasure. Certainly happiness seems elusive for a lot of people. I'm a psychotherapist, and I find that people can have moments of happiness or even periods of happiness, but it doesn't last. And they don't know how to continue it or how to create it to happen, even at the time that it's happening. And you're saying that there are laws that will allow us to increase the happiness in our own lives and create that happiness at will. Is that correct?
Well, that's not exactly right that we will be able to create happiness at will. So in the same way that when, like in physics, so we discover the laws of energy and motion, that doesn't mean we can drive cars without using gas, but we at least understand how much gas do you need to get from A to B, or whether that's feasible, or how to build more efficient cars. So it allows us to understand the constraints and the possibilities and how to given these limitations, how to make the most happiness out of the resources we have. So that's, in that sense, that's the way laws are to be understood.
Great. I'm glad you clarified that for me. Also, you mentioned, and I heard this on the radio this week, that the country of Bhutan, which is between India and China, has started to measure itself according to its gross national happiness index instead of its GNP. They're saying essentially that how happy their citizens are is more important than how wealthy they are. And I would have said, had I not read your book, that it would be impossible to even measure a gross national happiness index, but it's apparently not. Is that so?
Right. So we could talk a little bit on how to measure and define happiness, because that's the key thing so that measurements of well-being or happiness can complement measurements of economic performance. Because I think many people would agree that ultimately what matters is that we are happy. But if it cannot be measured with any reliability, then we always stick to like, for example, economic measures that are more reliably easy to measure. So the way to understand happiness in a way that can be measured there are basically two ways. One is asking people to make self-reports of how happy they feel overall at any given moment in time. So in this way, it's very easy to administer. It's very easy to collect lots of data based on that, because you just ask a simple question to lots of people, and then you can repeat that question like after 6 months, another time after 6 months, and through that you can get an idea of how the average happiness of the, let's say, of a group of people or the population is moving. So Gallup currently is like running this type of surveys, and like, for example, interesting thing if you look at the data is that when the 2008 economic crisis hit, happiness decreased for 3 months, but reverted back to normal again after 3 or 4 months. So it just it shows how relative happiness is. So it's very sensitive to changes, but then it adapts to the new level. So that's the first way, through general surveys. The second way, and that would be more to measure individual happiness, is not as for overall evaluations, but instantaneous evaluations. Like, what are you doing now? How do you feel about it? And then you want to make those evaluations very frequent. Like, for example, every half an hour you would ask, what are you doing now? How do you feel about it? Mm-hmm. Or at random times during the day, you will get a pager on your cell phone, and then you will have to answer a very short questionnaire. What are you doing now? How do you feel about it? And in this way, you measure what's called moment-to-moment happiness, and then link to the activities you are doing, and then see how it evolves during the day or in different life circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, keep going, yes.
So as of now, for let's say for a country, it is the first type of surveys that people would use more often, because they are more easy to ask thousands of people and just get an average of happiness. But for it seems that for scientific purposes, this more frequent measurement is more reliable on how happy are you, because if I ask you overall how happy you are, it's very difficult to integrate all the emotions you have experienced over the last few months in a single answer. Whereas if I ask you every half an hour, what are you doing, how do you feel about it, then it's reliable. Your answer reflects the feeling of the moment, and it's much easier to remember that and report an accurate number. So those are like the two approaches. And some things coincide, so like obvious things, so people who are married or have a job report more overall and daily happiness than those that don't. But then in some other things, there's a bit of mismatch, like there are puzzles. For example, when you ask people on the daily, day-to-day moments, it seems that raising children lowers day-to-day happiness, but then on an overall scale, it seems that it increases people's happiness. Or for example, in a day-to-day measurement, things that lower day-to-day happiness would be commuting. That's the one factor that has been found to lower a lot day-to-day happiness, and then the one that has very positive effects is socializing. So, like being with family, friends. That is the one factor that matters the most in day-to-day happiness. At the same time, when you look at overall happiness, you also find things that make sense, like, again, so being married or cohabiting increases happiness, having a job, being working for yourself makes you more happy than having a boss. So this all contributes to happiness. Health is another clear factor that does. And then unemployment is one of the divorce and unemployment. It's like all the two main factors that decrease happiness. Mm. So those are ways to measure and to understand what is it that matters and doesn't matter. And I can see that as technology advances and people have handheld phones and can communicate easy and can report answers much easier, it's going to be more and more feasible to really pulse the happiness of a country through continuous measurements of how people are feeling and at any given moment. So if we have that reliable measurement, then you can start thinking on, okay, this particular measure, this particular policy increase happiness of our citizens by this much, and that's going to be really nice to just base policies based on actually how much better off that makes people.
I told you before the show that I just returned from a short trip for my niece's graduation, and I was talking with people while I was gone, people that have been in my life for a long time, about how technology has actually made us a lot happier with each other. That when I was growing up, for example, if somebody went off to do something, there would be no way to contact them, and you'd end up with conversations like, I waited here for 3 hours for you. Where were you?
Right,
well,
right.
I thought you told me over here. So already technology is helping us to be a little happier.
Right. I recently joined RAND Corporation. So now I have two affiliations, the Pompeu Fabra one that you mentioned, and also I'm senior economist now at RAND Corporation here in Santa Monica. That means I'm away from my family, and it's amazing how you can then have video conferences with family, something that 5 years ago was not so easy. So in that sense, given that socializing family, friends is one of the most important factors for happiness, technology seems to be helping a lot in that direction.
But like so many things, I mean, there are mitigating factors with happiness. I got very fascinated with your discussion of the three people who were given X 100 coins to get an automobile over a certain period of time, and in essence, coming out with the notion that if you delay your happiness just a little bit and
you obtain
move
more,
in on
right.
That it lasts longer and
right.
you have
so,
more
so
of
here
it.
Is the part of the book where we talk about how to make efficient use of the resources to maximize happiness. And the key thing is certain things are very absolute. Like, for example, health or friends, those things are absolute. So the more you have, the more happy you will be. But then most of the other things, the consumer goods, and are essentially very relative. So happiness is very relative when it comes to non-basic goods. Like basic goods are a short list: friends and health, maybe some certain hobbies that you always enjoy, like exercising or a walk, or so those things always work. But past that, like comforts, luxuries, indulging in a vacation or things like that are very relative. That means that we always compare with some reference, and that reference can be well, the last resort that I went, or the car I am used to have, or the office space I'm used to have. So things like that are very relative. That means that our happiness will be what we get minus the expectation that we have, and that expectation is going to be typically either our past, what we have consumed or obtained in the past ourselves, or some comparison with peers, some social comparison. So I'm going to be happy with my office if it's the same size or bigger than my colleague, or the car. It's going to make me happy if I can compare favorably with the previous car I had, or the one that some neighbor or some relative or somebody with whom I compare would have. So given this relative nature of happiness, one can ask, well, if I cannot change that, so I understand that happiness is relative, how can sequence things to maximize happiness? And we came out with a model, and a mathematical model that we solved. And generally speaking, what maximizes happiness are increasing sequences. So going from less to more. Mm-hmm. So if you, for example, go on a vacation and you visit a city that has five highlights, you may want to leave the best for last, so that you can look forward to that, and then also always there is a surprise, because if you do the best thing at the beginning, then everything else would look just okay compared to this best thing that you saw. So if for example, you could think of like going to, if you go to Barcelona, for example, that's my city, so you want to visit the Sagrada Familia, not the first thing. So you may want to visit that the second to last day or the last day that you are there, mm-hmm. just to give an example. So then everything else from Gaudí, you enjoy everything else from the architect, and then the last day you see the big masterpiece, for example.
Yes. Yes,
so
yes, I've seen those masterpieces. Those are great. But let me just ask you a contemporary question about that. In our culture, a lot of people are now writing, we've talked with some of them on this show, that our former level of consumerism and economic well-being needs to be downsized. So we're actually
here is where the laws give a very counterintuitive answer. So you can run the model also in this scenario. So imagine that all of a sudden your expectations are too high. So you and then you don't have, your reality can really not match these expectations. What do you do? And then let me ask you three possibilities and see what your intuition says. Possibility number one would be to little by little spend less. So imagine you are overspending, let's say a family. So all of a sudden the family income drops suddenly, and they cannot support their standard of living. So they have to cut expenses. So there are three possibilities. One is little by little cut expenses. So at the beginning they would still overspend. At some moment they would match the income. But of course, during that period, they would have accumulated more debt. So then later, they have to keep cutting until they manage to return the debt. So that would be a gradual adjustment of the expenses, that initially they would be higher than income and then later lower than income, so that finally they can balance their debt. That's one strategy. The other would be to immediately readjust expenses to the new income level and then keep that steady at that level. So if I'm used to spend 100 and now my income is 80, the first strategy would be to do 95, 90, 85, 80, and then I have to go down because I have accumulated debt, right? Mm-hmm. The second strategy would be to immediately switch your expense level to your income level, 80, and then keep it there. The third one would be to cut expenses even further than your income. Go down to 60, for example. So just really make a very drastic cut in your expenses. Go down to 60. Keep at 60 for a while until you get partially adapted to this much lower living standard. And then there you can start gradually going up to 65, 70, 75, 80, and even past 80, because now you have saved money, because you have been expending 60 when your income was 80, and then you can do 80, 85, 90, 95, and so on. So the question would be, which of those three do you think is best?
Well, let me see if I learned something from reading your book. I'm going to pick C, that you lower your expectations and then gradually build up. That would give you the greatest happiness.
Right. That's if our laws are true, that is the one that would maximize happiness. So you have to cut on expenses that are relative. So you cannot cut on food, or you cannot cut on health, or on spending time with friends. But you could cut on lots of adaptive goods, lots of things that you would adapt to the new situation. And if you understand the relative nature of happiness, so the optimal thing is to really cut even more than your new current level of income. That's very counterintuitive. So most people would intuitively answer a gradual decline. But this gradual decline will just make you slightly unhappy for the whole time, because you will be consuming a bit less and a bit less and a bit less than the previous time, so you will always be on the down slope and continuously unhappy. If you adjust your expenses to your income to 80, then you will be very unhappy at the beginning, and then little by little you will go back to neutral. But if you cut heavily at the beginning, then you will be extremely unhappy at the beginning, but you will also rapidly adjust to this new situation. And then once you are adjusted sufficiently, then you can be happy again by increasing to 65, 70, 75, 80, and so on. So you would have then recovered again this hope, this looking forward to new things, this tomorrow is going to be better than today. So this is exactly what makes us happy, this ladder that we go from less to more. But the key thing is, it's not important if the ladder is high or low. The important thing is that it's increasing. So first you go down so that then you can climb up the ladder again. That is the logic that we are trying to argue for.
Yes. I'm thinking as you're talking that there are several politicians you may wish to speak to about how to do this. We're up to our first break. We're talking today with Manel Bosells, who's business and economics professor and author of Engineering. He's co-author of Engineering Happiness. And you can find out when you come back why a millionaire living in a mansion is barely happier than a Maasai warrior living in a hut. You're listening to Full Power Living, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, incredible communication that helps you create incredible kids by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have just a few announcements. Next week on June 14th, I'm talking with the amazing Robin McKenzie, who's still walking tall at the age of 81, helping people around the world to deal with back and neck pain. And we discuss material from his book, Seven Steps to a Pain-Free Life. He offers you the opportunity to deal with back and neck pain on your own effectively so you don't have to continue to suffer. Please join us for this relevant discussion, this discussion that's relevant to all of us and to your emotional well-being as well. The following week, we have a very special 90-minute broadcast about the nature of your personal reality when Seth expert Paul Helfrich and synchronicity expert neuropsychologist Dr. Kirby Surprise go head-to-head talking about how to understand the individual and collective experience in which we live and how we can change and work with it according to our attention, our beliefs, and our intentions. You can check upcoming shows at the top of the radio show page on emotionalpro.com, and we hope you don't miss a single episode of Full Power Living, because in listening, you are helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. Talk with us right now on either of our chats, emotionalpro.com or blogtalkradio.com/FPL, or call us 800-630-7858. Our guest today is Professor Manel Bassels, who's author of Engineering Happiness, A New Approach for Building a Joyful Life. And before we dive back into our regular questions, Manel, I want to ask you that since you have done your research on happiness and focused on it for 10 years, has the amount of happiness in your own life increased? And if so, how can you tell?
That's a difficult question. I would say that at least I understand better why I'm happy and unhappy at moments. So it's essentially not possible to be happy all the time. That's impossible because there are so many factors that are outside our control. And also, as I said, happiness is very relative in nature. So it if a new colleague shows up that has a better life than you, or you just judge that colleague has a better life than you, all of a sudden you can make you unhappy for a while, or things break and people get sick and things happen. So what I have learned is that when bad things happen, I know that sooner or later I will adapt to it. So I know that that unhappiness is not going to be everlasting. And I also know that relying on friends is going to work, and then I try to apply this design of going from less to more when I prepare a treat, just always making sure that the best things are at the end. So things like that I apply. There's one part in the book that we talk about goals and what we describe as cumulative goods. That to me is a fundamental part of at least my life, which is those things that when we do them, we have a sense of building up, of accumulating, like working for a project, having certain goals like exercising or in hobbies, setting up goals for ourselves or developing relationships. So all those things have naturally this accumulation, and that accumulation produces precisely the ladder effect, the effect of going from less to more. And in that case, they do so in a continuous way that gives a very steady and reliable source of happiness. So this is something that I do apply for myself. Again, what our book focuses are not on, let's say, very micro strategies. We think on like macro strategies, things that are going to work on, things that you can plan for, for to increase happiness in let's say in the long run. Because, for example, that strategy that we talk about to cope with, let's say, reduced incomes, that doesn't, it's not possible to be happy throughout. That's simply not possible. But to maximize happiness, we're saying make yourself very unhappy at the beginning so that you can recover hope and happiness later. So the goal is to maximize the total sum, but moment by moment happiness cannot possibly be made positive all the time.
That sort of goes against our grain. We don't usually like to bite the bullet and go ahead and live penuriously. We'd rather resist the change. So
it's an
interesting thing for us to do. Well, before the break, I brought up this issue that you mentioned, that our culture, of course, has been focused on consumerism, and people have been spending billions of dollars on things like perfume or fashion or cars or entertainment, seeking happiness. And it doesn't really buy us happiness. And you mentioned that often American millionaires that live in large, luxurious houses or mansions are barely happier than a Maasai warrior in Kenya living in a hut. Why is that?
Right. So there's an ongoing debate on to which extent money increases happiness. The general consensus is that the effect is small or is moderate or small. It is large if you are poor. So then, let's say below $20,000, every additional $1,000 will make you very happy. But essentially, past a certain point, money just buys you very adaptive relative things. And in fact, there is some research showing that past an income of about $70,000 a year, happiness is essentially flat past that. To us, that is because of the relative nature of happiness, so and also the role of social comparison. So if you have a lot of money, you would probably be surrounded by people having similar amounts of money, and then you begin this race this moved to a better house, this one has a bigger living room, this one has a bigger swimming pool, this one has a bigger this, bigger that, and then you also want to match, because if you don't, you're unhappy, because you're comparing negatively to others. Now, once you match them or exceed them, you would be happy for a while, you compare positively, but then they will imitate you, and then you will go back to neutral. So that's what's called the rat race. A rat race is when you have these hamsters running, but they always stay in the same place.
Right.
So it's in the long run, that's what it is. So in the long run, everybody's trying to catch up with the other, but since they all do the same, their happiness always stays at the same level because, for a while they are trailing, for a while they are ahead, but in the long run they are all like about at the same level and equally happy. So that is puzzling. At the same time, it poses a philosophical question, which is competition, or this type of competition, is what drives a lot of process in nature. Like, trees are tall because they compete against each other for sun. So could we tell the trees, why don't you guys agree on a high limit so that you don't spend resources growing up, you know? But at the same time, then you get these wonderful sequoias and redwoods that are so tall and nice. So it's an interesting process. Like, is this rat race a total waste, or it's actually the way we are, and it's okay that the world works like that?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, when it comes to happiness, past a certain level where your basic needs are covered, especially if you spend money on what's called conspicuous goods that are based on comparing with others, then you will be happy for a while once you outrun others, but then you will be trailing when others outrun you, and in the long run, happiness is not going to increase for the sum of all. This is an astounding problem, or an astounding puzzle. Is this the way things are going to be? Is this good? Is this bad? How can we change the game in a way so that people become actually happier? This is really a very fascinating question.
It definitely is. And I know in more than one place in Engineering Happiness, you talk about people living an ascetic life, like monks who really don't actually have money at all, and yet are some of the happiest people by your studies.
Right. Well, basically the key observation is that our emotional state is a product of mental processes. So then some ascetic people or people that like to develop a spirituality can achieve happiness by just spending time and energy in developing internal habits to cope better or to reach more positive mental states. So in our thinking, we think that will have a limit on how effective that time and effort put in developing a spirituality would go. So it's definitely optimal to spend some time every day in developing these habits of changing our attitudes, on looking at the bottle half full, on there are so many things that we can develop, like for example detachment, like an attitude of detachment or an attitude of not comparing, not having negative social comparison, like being happy when others do worse, but the opposite, just becoming happy when others are doing better. That is something that can be developed, or trying to look at the bright side of things, forgiving others. All these things they have a large potential to make day-to-day happiness higher, but they require time and some kind of faith that they are going to work, because at the beginning, while you don't possess the habit, you don't imagine yourself with that habit. You don't imagine yourself with the improvement installed in you. So then it takes a bit of faith to spend the time and energy in developing some of those habits. But definitely they pay off, because happiness is old, is a mental product. So if you can just develop better mental habits to deal with the good news, the bad news, the uncontrollable, the things that you don't control in your life, then it can make much more of a difference than material goods.
Yes. Well, now that's interesting, because on the chat we have a question that may be relevant to this. I'm going to just read it to you. Are these parental units happier because of their simplicity? Ask about whether being happier means we have to dumb ourselves down and live more simply. Do we give up doing things to some extent if we value happiness?
Well, what I can say is that it may work. So it may work to have a simpler life. It may work to adapt to a simpler way of living. But it is true that will be painful at the beginning, because if you have a certain standard of living, getting in a more simple life will be hard at the beginning. The key thing is to really find those things that are reliable sources of happiness, things that that they always work, like this, maybe this bicycle ride, maybe this time spent with these friends, maybe this hobby that you can develop, could be gardening, could be collecting a certain class of items that you like to collect, could be painting. So this type of things that always give you joy, those are the things that one needs to find, because they are not so adaptive. They will always work for you. And that's an issue of life balance, like how much time do you put in making money, income, versus how much time do you put in things that give this continuous joy.
Mm-hmm. And we're up to a break, but let me just read off the, you're talking about some of the 13 pillars of happiness which you list, and I want to just read those pillars. These are areas, as I understand it, that work for most people to bring happiness when we operate with them. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so those are meals, sleep, work, relationships, recreation, what you call crescendo, which is about saving the best for last, social comparison, the glass half full, the ability to reframe so that your glass is half full, which you just talked about, and small sips, where you space your consumption and build your craving, which you've also talked about, accumulation, where you set goals and create meaning and pile up things, which you also talked about, forgiveness, life balance, and learning to love, which involves compassion and spirituality and helping others. Those are the 13 pillars of happiness that work for most of us. So we're up to our second break right now. We're talking with Manel Bassells, who is business and economics professor and author of Engineering Happiness. And we'll be talking more about what you can do to increase happiness in your own life when we return from these messages. You're listening to Full Power Living.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Do you know that emotionally, children form the foundation for their life during their first 7 years? Most adults just repeat that early emotional learning, good or bad, over and over for the rest of their lives. If you want to give your child an opportunity to live an emotionally masterful life, then join me, Eileen Dillon, also known as the Emotional Pro, for a free one-hour teleseminar on what it takes for your child to become an emotional master. You'll discover important things like what emotions are designed to do for us, four things it's vital for parents to tell their children about emotions, and the single most important thing to do when someone is feeling emotion. Register now at RaiseIncredibleKids.com. The time has come for us to allow emotions their rightful place in our lives as the tools and helpers they're created to be. Find out what you need to know in order to give this vital information to your children so they can live emotionally masterful lives. Go now to RaiseIncredibleKids.com for your free Emotional Mastery Teleseminar. We're back here on Full Power Living talking with Manel Bassells, who is business and economics professor and also working for the RAND Corporation and author of Engineering Happiness. Now, I want to be sure, Manel, before we end the show, to talk a little bit about the six laws of happiness. There's a chapter on each one, so I encourage people to read this for themselves. But there are six laws. They are comparison, motion of expectations, aversion of loss, diminishing sensitivity, satiation, and presentism. You mentioned before, for example, comparison, that happiness and unhappiness are triggered by our human tendency to compare. And we've talked a lot about motions of expectations that are that when we set up our expectations so that we end up getting more rather than less as time goes on, that we're happier. Talk to me a little bit about these laws and which ones which ones are most important and how can we work with them?
So the effort that we tried was to come out with a systematic way to look at happiness, like if you think of in physics, like the laws, the Newton's laws of,
right.
of the motion of the bodies. Or so our approach is try to come out with a similar set of laws that move happiness. So happiness is influenced by those laws. We have come out with organizing lots of research and lots of data on these six principles. They have already been discussed by many other researchers. So what's unique to our approach is to propose them in a unified and coherent way. I should also add that we have. It's possible to express those laws in mathematical ways and then to deal with those equations and then for example, when we discussed before, what's the optimal way to cope with reduced income? Then you just go to the formula and optimize the formula, and it's the answer that you get is this one. And then you can say, well, I think this answer is wrong, therefore one of the laws must be wrong. Or maybe the answer actually happens to be correct, and it is my lack of understanding of how happiness moves that makes me not see that would actually be the best thing for me. So that at least creates this open question of what is right, the laws or our judgment at a certain moment to figure out what's going to make us happy in the long run. So we have these six laws. So the first one is that happiness is relative, so it depends on the comparison with expectations. And we have already said that. Then that expectations move, and move depends on what the others do, social comparison, or what I have done in the past. That's habit formation or adaptation to our standard of living. Then there's third law is loss aversion, meaning that when the comparison is negative, that makes us more unhappy than when the comparison is positive. So that dealing with negative events is tougher than with positive, so that in order to maximize happiness, one needs to find ways to avoid negativity, even if it's at the cost of some positive things. So that would be law number three. Then we have the diminishing sensitivity. That's a very old principle. That like the second bite, it's not as good as the first bite. So somehow, if you have a big meal, it's not as optimal as having two medium-sized meals spread out. So that's diminishing sensitivity. Then we have satiation, which basically means that if you consume a lot of something, then you will enjoy less in the near future. And what this brings is like this spacing. So you want to space out things so that you can enjoy them more fully, and by creating this craving. So if you always indulge in what you want to do, it doesn't give as much joy as if you space out. So you really want to do the thing, and it really you really enjoy. So, for example, sometimes I would play golf. So if it's been a while that I have not played, I really look forward to it. Whereas if I have recently played, then it's okay. I would just not enjoy as much. So that would be the association. And then the final one is the most, in a way, more interesting, because it's presentism. And that generally means that we tend to think that what makes us happy now will also make us happy in the future. And that happens not to be true. So, for example, buying something that clearly makes you happy now. The thing here is it will not make you happy in a continuous way, because you will adapt to that possession, and therefore we don't easily see this adaptation process going on. So then we always think that this object will make me permanently happy, when it's going to be only transitorily happy. That's one example of presentism. The other would be, for example, something that has been shown in experiments. If you go and if you are hungry, you tend to think that you will always be hungry. So then if you go to buy and you are hungry, you will buy more than if you are full. So that's called buying on an empty stomach. Then people purchase more. And the opposite is true. If you have in Thanksgiving just eaten turkey and you're completely full, you will predict that you will not eat turkey anymore in your life. Well, in reality, after 2 or 3 days, you are fine and you will eat turkey again. So it's this... In the example of coping with reduced income, for example, makes you predict that if you cut on standard of living, you will be permanently unhappy, because you are not anticipating that you will adapt to this lower income level. And this lack of anticipation makes it tempting to go for option A, like reduce little by little. Mm-hmm. But if you just see through the problem, you say, well, I know I'm going to adapt to whatever new life circumstance. So given that, why don't I set a very drastic cut in my living expenses? It's going to be tough, but I know I'm going to adapt. That's the leap of faith that you need to do to believe in that, because your intuition will tell you that that's not the case. Your intuition will tell you will not adapt. Mm-hmm. But if you just make that leap of faith, then adaptation will actually happen, and then you will have safe resources because you're spending less than your income, and then you can allow yourself to go from less to more again. So that's the law number 6, that's presentism, and it's probably the one that it's more difficult to deal with, because basically says that what we predict is going to make us happy doesn't actually work the way we predict. But in a consistent way, so we can see patterns there. We can anticipate, or people would think that A makes them happy, but in reality it's B that works. Mm-hmm. That would be the 6th law.
Thank you.
And then out of these 6 laws, the 13 pillars just come out as like a let's say consequence.
Thank you for going through those. There's a phrase that I coined some years ago working with people who were struggling with their problems, that you can't always see tomorrow with today's eyes. And that I think is presentism.
That's exactly perfect. That's exactly if we had known this, I would probably would have phrased it this way in the book.
Good. Well, when you edit, you know, in a few years, you're free to use that. Okay, just remember who told you.
So Alain Delon said that you cannot see
tomorrow.
Today's eyes tomorrow.
Yes. So what do you say about how emotions fit? I know you talk about emotions all through the book. What's the essence of how emotions actually fit into the engineering of happiness?
Well, to us, emotions are the the starting point of the whole of the definition of happiness. So happiness is the sum over time of the positive emotions that we experience minus the negative emotions that we experience. So that's the very definition of happiness. It's our feelings, our emotional life. So what we are trying to do is put our rationality at the service of our emotions by just trying to make decisions and set up things so that we experience more positive emotions and we reduce the time that we spend on experiencing negative emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So emotions are at the starting point of the whole setup. So at the beginning of the book we talk about this happiness seismogram, that some hypothetical recording of the intensity and the sign, whether it's positive or negative, of every emotion that you're feeling moment by moment. And it is the area under this curve that defines what happiness is.
Mm-hmm. And by knowing the laws and how they work, you know, I've worked with emotion for a long time, and it's not that we ever are devoid of emotion. You can't get rid of emotion. You keep on having it. It's that when you understand how it works or how you can work with your emotion to maximize the amount of happiness that you have, that you actually are utilizing what it is that you're talking about in your book, Engineering Happiness. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Right. So the that's exactly right. So what the goal here, and still a long way to go to really understand what drives emotions, and it actually goes two ways. What factors drive emotions, and then the emotion itself drives our behavior, which in turn generates new emotions, which in turn generates new decisions and actions, and that creates a very complicated system, and that's like how our lives develop. But understanding how this works, and then like a little bit from outside of ourselves, trying to see how our emotions are, some of them more reliable than others, some of them more lasting than others. So then how can we deal with our emotions and how to react to them? That's the goal of this. That's the philosophy that we are trying to develop.
Yes. Well, I'm certainly in appreciation of that. That's in my work. That's where I'm headed also. Now, here's an interesting question. Mostly, happiness occurs, or we're aware of happiness in the present. And yet, you mentioned something in the book that parents often, and you mentioned it here earlier too, that parents often are busy and working hard and don't feel so happy at the time that they're parenting, but when they look back, they feel like they're happy about having children. When does happiness occur?
Well, happiness occurs at every instant. So, okay, but the thing is that happiness can be triggered by, let's say, three things. It can be triggered by anticipating something in the future, so that can make you happy now, like looking forward to the weekend, looking forward to some event, looking forward to something in the future. It can also be while you experience that event, and also it can be while you remember the past events. That creates a very interesting puzzle, because it turns out that most, if you look at the total happiness that you get, it's very often the case that the happiness that you obtain during anticipation and recall is much, much higher than what you anticipate during the happiness you experience during the event itself. Sometimes the event can be very short, like, for example, meeting a celebrity. So you can be dreaming about meeting the celebrity for a couple of weeks, and then that meeting is just 1 minute. So no matter how intense that happiness during that minute is, it cannot amount to very much. So most of it is the anticipation of the event, and then the recall, and telling your friends, and looking back to that. And we could make a long list of events that are like that, where what counts is how much anticipation I get out of that, how much recall do I get out of that. There are lots of events in life that what we are trying to do is just have a very nice recall for the rest of our lives, like a wedding or a nice trip or a nice whatever, like 50 years anniversary. So we're trying to build up some memorable event, and that matters. And then, but happiness is always the same definition: is how do you feel at every moment. But if at that moment I'm recalling the past, then I'm being happy about having created very nice memories.
Ah, uh-huh.
And that's in this example, that rationally speaking, that would be the thought that it's painful at the moment, but you are creating very, very good memories. It's like an investment in future happiness. Then later you will be able to go back and go through the pictures and enjoy the moments, and that's just going to be like a way to make you happier in the future, let's say.
Thank you for clarifying that. We just gave my husband a retirement party, and he had a 50-year desire to conduct an orchestra. And through a wonderful young man, we had 26 volunteer musicians who came together and allowed him to conduct a 4-minute piece, the prelude or the overture to the opera, The Marriage of Figaro by Mozart.
And did you record the...
Yes, we have a wonderful video recording as well.
Right, because that's also important for recalling memory.
The past recollection, yeah. So that's a really great experience or example of what you're talking about there. Well, thank you so much. I was so aware as I was reading that you're actually giving us the scientific basis of many things that spiritual teachers have been advising us about for centuries and putting them in the language of science. And I found it fascinating to encounter the approach that you and Professor Sarin have about happiness, and having those six laws of happiness is very comforting so that we can build and sustain and know something more about what we're doing when we're actually intending to be happier in our lives. So I want to thank you for your work and for sharing it with us through your book, Engineering Happiness, and by coming here on Full Power Living today to talk with us about it. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Eileen.
Yes. Next week on June 14th, I'll be talking with the best-known physical therapist in the world, Robin McKenzie, about 7 steps for pain-free living. Find out the simple ways you can correct and improve your own posture and or back pain and neck pain. So join us live on June 14th and every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern Time, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. Thank you, Paul Johnson of Fresh Talk Media, our show's producer, and for you, our wonderful listeners who participate on our chat. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
To Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.